This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers, and it's 2026, and are you ready to take control of your financial future? Meet Portfolio Analyst from Interactive Brokers, the free all-in-one dashboard that lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all your financial accounts in one place. You don't need an IBKR account to use it. Just connect your accounts and see your complete financial picture, your investments, performance, and allocation all in a single screen. Plan smarter with IBKR's new tax and retirement planners built around your goals and market assumptions. Get deep portfolio insights with detailed risk assessments and compare performance against more than 300 benchmarks. Plus, manage with confidence thanks to GIPS verified returns. Are you ready to get started? Sign up for a portfolio analyst free for everyone at IBKR.com/freePA. Interactive Brokers, the best informed investors, choose IBKR. Member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Prospective perspective. We are looking ahead by looking back. A new year, what may drive returns into 2026? And so many guests throughout the year, so much wisdom. We kick off another great year of the TDI podcast. All this and much more on episode number 954 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to 2026. Did you ever think you'd get there? I remember when I was all excited about the year 2000. I'm like, wow, that's a long time in the future. And boy, what's going to be? Thinking about, you know, spacecraft and computers and all the things that could be, you know, 20 years in the future when you see what went on with HAL, with the Space Odyssey, and of course with Star Trek and Star Wars and all the things there. But we are here. We're here. It is 2026. And did you start working out yet? Did you start your diet yet? Did you start giving in to any of that stuff already? I hope not. Even though there are a lot of Mondays that we could start our diet, make every day count. Life is short. Let's be honest. So we are here, and what is happening? What is happening? What happened last year? You know, we look back and a lot of things were rather surprising as we look into what actually occurred last year, because we had a lot of volatility that was based on some crazy stuff that went on, especially mid-year in April. Started out a little bit rocky, but in April, things really got crazy. U.S. equities closed the year, even with all of the things that we had and all the headwinds, with solid gains that was driven largely by what? By technology, right? That's what was, again, the driver of all this. That actually was part of it. There was a broad-based overall trend that lifted all ships. That tide was rising. But the leaders that were really playing were all generated around the AI trend and that wave that seems to have massive amount of money that's being thrown at it. It's pretty cool to watch. Now, the growth-oriented sectors, well, they outperformed, as you would expect. But the broader indices posted healthy advantage from the small caps all the way up to the large caps, the value side and the growth sides. That was good. International markets, what a great year. Surpassed the benchmarks in the U.S. for the first time, by the way, in over a decade. And emerging markets, wow, delivered incredible results with several countries. And some of the ones that you wouldn't have expected to, leading, like China. Who would have thought China was going to do anything, right? With all the sanctions and the problems and the issues with their economy and the slowdown with industrial profits and the problems that they have with real estate and the issues that they have with their banks, all of that. But it was good. And you had countries like South Korea. Oh my, what an incredible story there that was led by technology, of course, in their countries, and Taiwan with Taiwan Semiconductor. We had commodities doing really well. one of the strongest years in recent memory. Think about all the years that oil was kind of doing nothing. Gold, silver, it's kind of hanging out there. Copper, yeah, doing all right. But more, boy, oh boy, the precious and industrial metals were surging throughout the year. It started with a concern about uncertainty in central banks buying. Then there was some ideas that maybe silver was going to be used in areas like maybe battery production, as well as in the technology area, particularly with semiconductors. Energy prices throughout 2025 softened. Meanwhile, the weaker dollar, big story here, down about 9.5% on the basket of currencies for the year, really boosted returns for the international investments. And bonds, well, they rallied as central banks around the world decided to go towards much more accommodative policies that was aligned with a disinflationary trend that took hold. Now, meanwhile, by the way, we have to state that inflation is not dead. It's just better. It's still high. We know that. I'm not going to go into this because we talked about this 100 times, but you know, around the world, we're looking at 2.5 to 3%. Everybody still wants 2%, but 2.5 to 3% is still the average. But central banks felt that they were getting ahead of the curve and can start working on their policies to be much more accommodative than restrictive. But you have to admit that during 2025, the bulls were the story. Firmly in control throughout the year. Momentum, which was fueled by this massive AI investment that we talked about, was pretty impressive. News release after news release talked about better earnings, but also talked about capital expenditures, CapEx. That was not small by any means. I mean, huge numbers that was going into play to build some part or buy some particular semiconductor or advance some technology or something around the idea that energy was going to be needed. And this whole new emergence of a brand new sector, generally speaking, on top of a hot sector, it drove optimism. The corporate spending that went on and that was committed to over the next 3 to 5 years or more, pretty impressive. But at the same time, we have to look a little bit beneath the surface because beneath the surface, there's some stress. There's a few warning signs that are starting to emerge. There's no question about that. We have the concerns and the constant discussions that you hear about stretched valuations in certain sectors, and particularly some of the technology area. They're there on a constant basis. They're not easy to ignore by anybody because if you just look at the levels of where we are, they are consistent with market tops, generally speaking. It doesn't have to be an immediate top, but I got to tell you, what we're seeing throughout the last quarter of this year, particularly into the end of this year, where Santa did not show up really for the rally that was supposed to be. Even though it was a good quarter, the end of the year was a little bit slow when it came to many of these areas. And when we add the lingering trade tensions and the uncertainties about shifting monetary policy, we have a little bit more of a nuanced picture than just saying, yeah, the S&P 500 is going to be 7,500 at the end of next year, simply slapping on another, 7 or 8%. To where we are now. It's a lot more that needs to go into it. And I find that it's really kind of gross that time after time, whether it's Bloomberg or CNBC or Fox Business or, pick your poison, these analysts just come on and just simply give us a very, I would say, uneducated view of just let's post the optimism and then it will follow. They really don't allow for many of the naysayers to come on board. That would be bad. We can't have somebody saying that the market's going to go down next year. And nobody's going to listen anyway because the optimism is so great right now with the idea that we're going to get a new Fed chair coming in April, and they're going to be very accommodative, looking at 2, 3, 4. I don't even know how many cuts, because just that's what everybody wants. But for now, let's be very clear about something. Very clear. The trend is still our friend. And it's important to recognize that the opportunity and risk are really running side by side. And the Bulls and Bears, if you want to look at it that way, are pretty much neck and neck right now. But the Bulls have been doing a much better job because the news flow is very positive for their cause. And as the new year begins, I think that we need to make sure to maintain discipline, embrace diversification, and that's what's going to be our main strategies here as we manage money for clients into 2026. We're going to look to capture upside while staying prepared and very aware and open-minded to there could be sudden shifts in the market's, you know, the market's way of being at this point. And that has happened before and we see it. And right now, it seems to be ripe for that kind of situation. But what are we looking at specifically for 2026? I just want to kind of throw this out very briefly. There are a lot of geopolitical tensions that are going on. And some of the recent enthusiasm in the tech trade may be a little bit overdone, right? That's what we're talking about. And the defense sector looks like a sector with strong fundamentals and some clear catalysts right now. So we have the Trump administration is signaling a more aggressive stance. We changed from the Department of Defense to the Department of War. They're looking at more a greater level of military readiness and offensive capabilities, talking about building massive warships. So we're expecting, and I don't think anybody would argue this, accelerated procurement for strategic platforms, right? Missile defense systems, modernization programs, and that creates a rather compelling backdrop for U.S. defense contractors. So we're seeing this, right? The rising tensions in places like Ukraine and Taiwan and Nigeria, Venezuela, Middle East. Well, some of them are not rising, they're there. And this is fueling a surge in allied orders, export demand for advanced defense systems. There's a lot of companies out there, and you know, many of them, for example, like who do we have? Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, like Raytheon, right? The surge in Patriot missile requests, aerospace recovery, strong international demand, huge backlog. Northrop Grumman, the B-21 radar production acceleration, the Sentinel ICBM program, space and cyber growth, hypersonic contracts, backlog $80 billion. General Dynamics, the Gulfstream deliveries are ramping up, Virginia-class submarine contracts, new surface combatant programs, defense IT modernization, $103 billion backlog. Pretty good. You know, EPS growth, Raytheon about 36% with a forward PE of 25. Northrop Grumman, APS growth expected to be 10% with a forward PE of 20, so that's not as compelling. General Dynamics, 18% growth on the forward basis, 20 on the PE. So while the market's been focusing on technology stocks where valuations, again, appear a bit stretched, some of this is kind of interesting. So what are we doing? We're looking at these kinds of names, but we're also looking at things like the ETFs that are in the area of defense, like SHLD and ITA and a few others. We're looking for those and implementing for those for our clients right now and put some of that into place already, looking for a place to have opportunity and also a place to be somewhat more exempt from the potential rollover if technology does roll. Something to think about, something to look at into 2026. Now, we have something that we're about to share right now, and that is the guest clips from 2025. Ryan Radisky, who is a great guy, puts together all of this for us on a regular basis. This is all about looking back and looking ahead. So, Ryan, thank you for putting this together and spending time on this. And it's going to be a lot of fun because if you listen, it tells you pretty much the guests that came on, a little clip what they talked about. These, if you may have to want to listen to this slowly. Listen to this over and over. Some great tidbits and discussion and idea generation from the guests. Before we do that, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers again, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are just from 4.14% to 5.14%. In fact, IBKR was rated one of the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's clients' low margin borrowing costs to other brokers like Schwab or E-Trade, Fidelity and Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points above IBKR's low rates. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Now, margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. Rates are subject to change. Get started today at ibkr.com/compare. IBKR is a member of SIPC. Now let's get it on. Let's hear about this guest clips that was put together by our good friend Brian and find out what was going on and see if we have any ways of getting a glimpse at maybe opportunities for 2026.
Episode 903, Pat Kamusu.
If you take a crypto and you just put it into a contract, delegate it to a contract, and then that provides you a yield, that's not going to be a taxable event. But if you were going to exchange a crypto or multiple cryptos for another token, like a UniV2 position, or, you know, going from ETH into WETH, to where you're going to get some yield off of it, but also you're getting a new asset with a new liquidity profile to it, that's really the difference.
Right.
Episode 904, Ryan Zabrowski.
The longer the time horizon is for a portfolio, the heavily the weighted should be valuation factors. So we know what is the most predictive of future return. Those are valuation factors, but that work is only really predictive over 7 to 10 years.
So you're looking at like
if your time horizon for performance is shorter than 7 years, you have to assign weights to technical analysis. I call it market health. You want to be taking more risk in a healthy market, and a market that's health is waning and starting to roll over. That's when you need to be careful. You know, that's what we saw in the
episode 905, Howard Linton.
The degenerate economy is nobody's fault. It's just this culmination of technology and culture and ZERP and rigging and the class war, you know, the writ, the haves versus the haves nots, all these things that have just happened. Blame whoever you want. But if you really step back and go, Jesus, it's obvious that kids are going to want to gamble. They can't afford a home. They've been screwed by the government. They have no COVID. Interest rates are now high. Their parents, they have anxiety. They've been fed sugar. They're vaping. And so you have these walking zombie. Yeah, I have two myself. I feel so bad for them. I felt when I graduated from college, I thought the world was my oyster. I can tell you from raising two, owning and operating two millennials that they are fucking stressed, okay?
Yep.
Because they're not stupid. They see prices.
Episode 906, Carson Block.
I mean, look, activist short selling, it's different from traditional short selling in that activist short selling is always intended to make money. It's an absolute return type of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it becomes harder when people care less and less about, you know, about these issues. And it's like Tesla, like, you know, whenever people talk to me, oh, why don't you talk about Tesla? Because everybody knows, right? And they don't care. So it's until there are real losses experienced and people remember why stewardship of companies is important and why the accuracy of information they're provided is important. Until that happens, it's just, it's, you know, it's a harder business than it really should be.
Episode 907, Danielle D. Martina Booth.
Again, go back to why so many companies that are reporting are beating their estimates. It's because they're in cost-cutting mode right now, meaning we're firing people or people are choosing to leave by way of attrition, quote-unquote.
Quote-unquote, yeah. Quote.
So that's one of the reasons that they are protecting their margins. And then you've also got this gigantic presence of passive investing in the market. And that just passive investing is more than 50% of inflows into the U.S. stock market. And it doesn't care what the price of NVIDIA is, it's going to buy it. If I take money out of my paycheck twice a month and that flows into my 401k and my 401k's got an index fund in it, I'm going to buy the stock no matter what the price is. And that is a powerful force to contend with.
Episode 908, Carly Garner.
The reality is I've been doing this long enough to know that you hedge first and then you ask questions later. Because if hope is your strategy, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, hope is not a strategy.
Yeah. So at some point we can fairly say we're probably wrong or at least very early. And so it's time to start hedging. In markets like crude oil or gold, there's micro futures and you can slowly incrementally hedge. And that's a really far preferable way to go. What we try to do is we try not to let any of our options become in the money. So for example, if we're short an option that has a strike price of 425 and coffee's trading at like 415, we really don't want that thing to go in the money. It's not the end of the world if it does, because a lot of, you know, it can come back down and so on and so forth. But if you sold an option with a strike price of 425 and you bought a futures contract at 425 and the market just kept going, even though you were wrong and it was a little bit stressful, you would still keep the premium you collected. So you actually would make money on a position you were exactly wrong on.
Episode 909, Vitaly Katsenilson.
We had technological changes before. And every single time you had a technological change, there was a bubble was developed in the stock market. The problem is the road to that change is not nonlinear, right? Think about it, 1999, how much internet has changed our life, right?
Yep.
But first, we had a huge bubble and a crash. And then it actually did change our lives. Now, NVIDIA today, it's a hardware company that basically, you know, that has margins as if it was a software company.
Right.
Because everybody wants its product.
It's like Tesla. It's like Tesla, yeah. Yeah, car company that has valuations like tech company.
No, exactly. No, actually, very true. Except NVIDIA, it actually has a literally, if you look at its income statement, and I did not tell you that it was a hardware company, you would not know that.
Right.
Episode 910, Meb Faber.
If you look at the average endowment, or you look at, say, my nemesis CalPERS here in California that manages hundreds of billions of dollars, or even if you look at Bridgewater, the largest hedge fund in the world, right? And you say these institutions have all the resources. They have access to the best investors all over the planet. They have teams of dozens, if not hundreds of employees, on and on. They should be able to outperform just a generic ETF buy and hold portfolio. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, historically, often they don't. So we've written a lot of articles over the years on Bridgewater, on CalPERS, say, should CalPERS be managed by a robot? Should CalPERS fire everyone and buy a bunch of ETFs?
Episode 911, Dr. Daniel Crosby.
When this country was founded, you know, 250-ish years ago, 85% of the world was living in poverty. Today, that number is 9%. So as a world, you know, capitalism has brought us this enormous bounty. The world is richer and more equal than it's ever been before. And yet we have this mental health crisis and this crisis of connection and loneliness and all of these sort of related concerns. Some of my previous work, the behavioral investor, if you're a hardcore dollars and cents quant type money manager, that's going to be more your style. But right now I'm loving this conversation around money and meaning and helping people take the wealth and the abundance they've created and spend, save it, invest it in ways that make them happy.
Episode 912, Steve Sanders.
We're more focused on providing the utility that allows our clients to trade anything they want around the world. And so you, on our platform, you can easily trade these markets or crypto, or, you know, there's been interest in bonds lately with interest rates, you know, that uncertainty, and certainly on FX rates, all these things. And, you know, I just heard the other day that there are a number of institutions that are, you know, trading between the markets. I mean, that's the third reason people go into these markets is arbitrage.
Yeah.
So they can buy crypto ETFs and sell the futures on the CME or vice versa.
Episode 913, Wes Gray.
We're going to look at the collective evidence of what everyone says, do our own research, try to replicate other studies, and knowing full well that we're never going to be perfect. But like, what do we think is genuine truth in the marketplace? And, you know, usually our standard is, and would I put my own money in this thing? It, you know, and that to us means evidence-based. Now, the problem with evidence-based as a term is it become bastardized because now everybody that runs a back test says it's evidence-based.
Right.
But that's different. Right. Evidence-based because you ran your own custom back test over a certain period under certain conditions that gives you the answer you want to say. That's not intellectual truth. That's just called, you know, fitting the data to the narrative. That's marketing.
Episode 914, David Geffen.
There is a lot of tinkering with economic levers, sort of with the notion that they are independent of one another. You know, it's, you know, yes, in this weird ideal world, you would, you know, in their minds, you would have a change in where our goods are being produced. There is a long valley between that on how you get to that point, if you can get to that point. And other things can happen. You know, you can have, you know, a recession, you can have job losses, you can find out that things that you planned don't work out. And as you were talking about capitalism, it's something I've been thinking about too. I mean, you are, you know, assuming that millions of independent economic actors will do what you want them to do, and they may not do that.
Episode 915, Tim Knight.
Because, you know, one more chartish thing that I'll sort of toot the horn at, and I'm not an expert at all, is Elliott Wave. Because Elliott Wave, I found stinks during bull markets, but during bear markets, I found it to be really, really, really helpful. And this notion that we're in, you know, and this is not to be conflated with the fourth turning, even though there's a number involved. If we're in the third wave of this particular move, it's kind of a big deal. Because everybody expects these things to only happen like in October. But, you know, so far, the whole Elliott Wave bang out of what's been happening has been just spot on. So that's another sign to me that, okay, this is really a bear market because it's acting like one.
Well, especially we saw the small caps already down 21% from top to bottom. That's bear market. Hello. Right?
Right.
Episode 916, Manuel Blay.
Well, we are market timers, but of course there are many breeds. So we are Dow theorist. So this means that we use the Dow theory in our own rendition, our own interpretation, which was developed by Jack Shanep. And the basic difference with the traditional Dow theory is that we also include the S&P 500. So we use three indexes, Dow Industrials, the Dow Transportation, and the S&P 500. Instead of just two indexes as the original or classic Dow theory does. The classic Dow theory only uses the Dow Industrials and Transportation, and Jack Shanep decided to include the S&P 500, which for me makes lots of sense because you know that the Dow theory is almost 130 years old. So at that time, we did an S&P 500.
Episode 917, Brian Dress.
If you remember back to COVID, when we went back down to the zero interest rate bound, a lot of companies went out and took advantage of that and issued quite a bit of debt at that time. So that was what, 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those were 7, 10, 15, or 20-year bonds. And so capitalization remains reasonably good, even in high yield land. obviously, if there are companies that have maturities coming up, meaning if they have bonds that are maturing soon, that may be more of an issue. And that's why we select individual bonds. We don't buy a whole, you know, we don't buy bond funds. But there are individual situations where companies remain well capitalized. Maybe they pay a dividend. So there's an option where they could stop paying the dividend and, you know, continue servicing the debt, things along those lines. That's the way we kind of look at things. Are there levers to pull?
Episode 918, Patrick O'Hare.
Even if the tariffs come off, I would venture prices don't come down. Thoughts?
Well, I think, yeah, right. That's, you know, you hear about it as being a one-time price adjustment, right? And, you know, I think we've seen here, even before this happened, right, is as we talked about inflation and the Fed talked about inflation coming down into the, you know, 2.5% range from where it was at, you know, 8-9%. It's better, but you still have inflation. And so the, you know, one of the keys is going to be is, you know, what happens to, you know, real wages, right? Can it keep up? Can it keep up with that? It's not going to keep up with 10%, certainly.
Episode 919, Dan Pilla.
Under the Biden administration, the Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which itself is a farce, but that's a different discussion. They appropriated $80 billion to the IRS.
$80 billion, it wasn't $700 billion.
$80 billion to the IRS over 10 years, right? Not all at once, but over 10 years, specifically to hire about 87,000 additional IRS workers. Congress clawed back 20 of that $80 billion. So it was carved down to $60 billion. In 2023, when that act was passed, over the next 2 years, 2024, 2025, 2026, about 30% of the IRS's workforce was eligible to retire. So that's the retirements that we're seeing right now. The people that are leaving the IRS were those that are eligible to leave the IRS anyway.
Episode 920, Dan Fargella.
Think about it this way. It's like, so tell me to read one book, never mind tell me to read millions and millions and millions of books, and then start asking me questions and see if I quote unquote hallucinate, right? Just see if I do. Try right.
It. Yeah, I got you.
So you can do this with your own fucking memories.
Write
down everything that happened on your seventh birthday and talk to your mom about it and figure out how much goddamn hallucinating you do.
Yeah,
and do they do this thing? Sure. And we are labeling it something different than what happens in our brain, probably because in part there is some difference between what happens in our brain. So hallucinations happen. I guess we sometimes forget, like, God, humans do a lot of the same thing.
Right.
Episode 921, Ed Easterling.
So the term secular, bull and bear market, secular, that comes from a Latin word, secula, which means an era or an extended period of time. When you apply it to stock market cycles, it says that these are stock market cycles of an era. In general, these are eras when the inflation rate is rising and causing the value of stocks to decline. And in what secular stock market cycles tell us is that when we start off with high valuations, we typically end up with relatively low returns over that next 7, 10, 20 year period. It's hard to categorize it right now. I would have to say it feels like a secular bull, but it has characteristics of the potential for secular bear.
Episode 922, Tom Nelson.
You know, the bond market is kind of the ultimate arbiter of kind of greed and fear, if you will. And the market has not liked what is going on as it pertains to the U.S.'s kind of fiscal situation right now. As of about an hour or so ago, the most read story on Bloomberg of the day, the headline is Trump's next hurdle, the bond market hates his beautiful bill.
Yeah, well, right.
And so that, you know, that sums up a couple of things from that perspective. But look, there, we saw a debt downgrade on Friday of last week, right? That was from Moody's.
Mm-hmm. If it was an upgrade that we said, well, that's because of our doing.
I think the rhetoric might be different on an upgrade.
Episode 923, Barry Ritholtz.
You know, to me, if I was, I guess I can't even say Jeff Bezos, it's whoever
what's his name? Jassy, who's
Andy
running?
Andy Jassy.
Yeah, like if I was him, it's like, hey, you know, you've spent 25 years building trust and you have completely blown trust. It's kind of amazing to see how they've gone from the single greatest thing in retail to meh, I don't really care.
I mean, it's still the easiest in a way. They're still very easy to deal with. That's the thing they have.
But this is not specific to Amazon or eBay or Google. This is the innovator's dilemma. This is eventually we all become victims of our own success. And that's really deeply problematic. And there's nothing you could do about it. It's just the nature of things.
Yep.
Episode 924, Frank Curzio.
I would put Amazon in kind of the metaphor as being every other country. Right. So, yes, it's nice to get cheap products from China. It's nice to get cheap products from Vietnam and Taiwan and stuff like that, whatever. But the bottom line is if they're raising prices or if they don't comply with tariffs, we could, just like you would do at Amazon, you might pay a little bit more, but you might go someplace else if this continues. And that's the threat. Now, what happens to Amazon? Amazon's going to get destroyed. What happens to these countries? They're going to get destroyed. If you don't have America buying all of their products that they're producing for cheap, what's going to happen to them? And then you throw in China. What's the catalyst in China? Everyone was buying China because of this massive stimulus. By the way, they've been stimulating the economy for the last 2 years, right? And they're like the bazooka stimulus. They've lowered their reserve requirements tremendously, and it hasn't done nothing because they're in a deflationary environment. And believe me, I have great contacts in China. It's 10 times worse than what everyone believes.
Episode 925, Steve Sanders.
What advice would you give advisors that are trying to differentiate themselves in all this tech that's out there?
Well, that's easy. Most people don't like to spend time reading or poring over documentation or anything else. I think it's human nature. You don't want to waste your time doing the homework. RIBKR Campus has all kinds of courses and everything from products to our technology. And if you just go in there and, spend a bit of time taking the courses, reading the documentation. And I'm not saying you should spend 60 hours a week, but maybe if you devote 5 hours a week to partaking of this, it will make you a better trader if you do that homework.
Episode 926, David Geffen.
We are looking at, based on a various bunch of places, a decline overall in terms of expected growth around the world and in the United States. And so you have that, real step down in GDP growth that's anticipated. There's the immigration restrictions, the uncertainty around tariffs. And so I think that the concerns that people have raised, including you, about valuation are well-founded. My question would be, what then happens to work that out? Do you have a market that just goes sideways for most of the rest of the year? And then by that notion, kind of regains a valuation level that is a little bit more, I don't know what you would want to call it, appropriate.
Episode 927, Carly Garner.
For me, option trading is the way to go because I can structure strategies that I have lots of room for error and I'm not stressing myself out. Even, believe it or not, we were playing the downside in oil during this whole fiasco. We actually ended up coming out nicely ahead. And we didn't even really have that much stress because the way we'd structure our trade. So for example, when oil was at 55, we were bearish. But what we also knew, look, it doesn't make sense if we think oil's going to 48 and oil's at 57, doesn't make sense to be aggressively short because if something happens in the Middle East, all heck breaks loose. We're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's going to be no fun.
Episode 928, John Pugliano.
So, mm-hmm. So everybody goes back to the 1970s and looks at stagflation. But we have polar opposites from where we were in the 1970s. In the 1970s, we suffered through the energy crisis. And at the same time, it's when globalization was really exploding, right? That's when the term Rust Belt actually got invented, right? All the jobs, they weren't going to China back then. They were going to Japan or Taiwan or South Korea, whether it was car manufacturing in Detroit or, steel mills in Pittsburgh. That stuff was all going overseas. So our dollars were leaving, our dollars were going overseas to buy oil, and our jobs were going overseas. And so we not only had higher costs for energy, but we had lower prospects for jobs. So that was stagflation.
Episode 929, Larry McMillan.
So VIX is interesting. You really need to stay fairly short term because there's a steep term structure in the VIX futures, which is what the options are based off of. So you can have, if you buy a 6-month VIX and VIX explodes now, that 6-month future is not going to go up very much. But the 2-week one will definitely be exploding. If you only go out, you know, to the next month, about 33% out of the money. That, therefore, you're not spending a fortune on these calls. But when something happens, is your calls are definitely going to kick in.
Episode 930, Anthony Scaramucci.
Well, there's a great book by Neil Howe called The Fourth Turning, where he basically just describes that every 80 years, whether you like it or not, we lose the institutional living memory of why we have structures in place in institutions. And so this happened leading into the First World War. We're now 80 years out from the Second World War. So there are 40-year-old bureaucrats and diplomats around the world that are like, well, why do we have the IMF? The UN isn't workable. This is not right. That's not right. Even though these systems were put in place to prevent more wars, they've become dated, and now people want change. And so as they get to the change, the question is, are we going to get positive change or are we going to get negative change? And so
Episode 931, Jim Rogers.
Even though the Fed says they're, you know, tighter than we should be, we still have enormous amounts of debt out there. Is this debt issue going to eventually become too top heavy?
Well, Andrew, the United States is the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. No country has ever been so deep in debt. I've been around long enough that I think it does matter, and I think it's going, I know it's going to lead to gigantic problems for us, us being the U.S., before too much longer. It always has, and I'm afraid it will again.
I remember
the problem that I'm having is I don't know another currency or another market to where to go.
Episode 932, Thomas Fulton.
Well, one of the things that we have to all remember is that we are going to be wrong. And, you know, that's part of the process that we go through. We're wrong at times. And there's times to just, you know, cut and run, as you said. And then, you know, one thing that I really try and I stress to my people, size your positions properly. So, for example, if I'm initiating a new position in something, it's most likely going to be around a 2% weight of my portfolio. Mm-hmm. And if I'm down 10% on that, and I still believe in the idea, I have the ability to raise my position up to 5%. Sometimes I'll just cut. And sometimes if I feel like the position is and the idea really is relevant and good, I'll add to it.
Episode 933, Seti Ejit Das.
Just take one area, the automobile industry. And I noticed President Trump was saying that how foreigners are now going to buy a lot of American cars. Now, people may not be aware, but there's an existing 25% tariff on light trucks being imported into the United States. And this obviously helps American car makers. And American car makers have been encouraged by the tariffs to focus on these very, very highly profitable light trucks. And by the way, it's not only light trucks, because SUVs use the same basic components as these light trucks. So they've made these cars and they make a lot of them. But the problem is nobody internationally is going to buy them because overseas you have strict fuel economy standards. Secondly, the fuel prices, because there are taxes on fuels almost everywhere else in the world, are like double.
Episode 934, Meb Faber.
When you're talking about the NVIDIA with your client, you know, first of all, that's awesome. You know, tell him to pat himself on the back. But that's, you know, that's how the stock market works. And so, you know, we did this great chat with Professor Bessenbinder a while back, and he wrote a famous paper called Do Stocks Outperform Treasury Bills? And then I had him, I said, hey, you know, I'm curious, what's been the best performing stock of all time? And, you know, meaning of the last 100 years. And part of this, of course, has to do with just something that's been around for 100 years. So mm-hmm. NVIDIA has obviously not been around for 100 years, but theoretically, had you invested in Altria, which would be the old Philip Morris, you would have had a, hold on, I got to do the math here on this. It's like a 265,528,901% return.
So, wow.
You can, smoking and it's pace. About 16% per year.
Episode 935, Nolan Langford.
I think anything or most things consumer related right now are really struggling. So if you look at apparel, you look at retailers, even if you look at, you know, a lot of the retail stores, you know, Target, Chipotle just reported a weak report. Mm-hmm. Starbucks had some issues. Any place counting on the consumer outside of travel, because the consumer is still spending on travel and experiences. But outside of that, those areas are really having a hard time.
Episode 936, Danielle Park.
Oh, it's really become a mosh pit. In a lot of ways, we didn't crack down on the bad actors in 2008. Pretty much everybody walked. They got away with everything. They got bailed out. And we've really just magnified a lot of those behaviors since. You know, COVID was this huge, you know, meteor from outer space that really changed the world, so to speak, in the sense of we had massive bailouts. Like, you know, we thought we had massive bailouts in 2008. We got incredibly global massive
800,
bailouts.
Was it $800 billion? No, $800 billion was the full bailout back then in for
which,
all the banks?
In which aided and abetted this mosh pit of financialization, which has taken over everything.
Episode 937, Frank Curzio.
And this is something we talked about for a while. I mean, you hear me talk bullish about the market conditions overall, but, you know, we're bearish on a lot of names. Chipotle was another name that we've been bearish on for over a year, year and a half. Disney, we were very bearish on for a long time, for like 4 or 5 years. You know, listen, some of them we get right, some we get wrong. But Salesforce, we're very bearish on because, you know, they talk a big game. But when it comes to CRM systems, and if anyone has a business over 3 million, they know how important that is. You can't just use one system, right? You have to use a bunch of different systems. It's just some of them are good in other areas, credit card processing, you know, just labeling, going over marketing strategies and stuff like that, reading headlines, right? Now with AI, you could build, like, you could tailor it to yourself, and it's a lot cheaper. So it threatens all these companies. And I just, and, you know, Benioff was out there saying, hey, you know what? We're ahead of this. We're all AI. We're going, and but it's not showing up in the results. So when you're a CEO and you overpromise and underdeliver, you piss off your investors, right? And your biggest investors. And that's what they've been doing.
Episode 938, Peter Schiff.
The problem is going to come in this cycle. This is, I think, going to be the equivalent of the monetary overdose. Mm. Because the Trump administration and the Fed are going to be under the impression that if they just do what they did before, they'll get the same result, you know, and I'm talking about the monetary and fiscal policy that we had after the stock market crash the big tech bubble burst in 2001, 2002, the stock market or financial crisis of 2008, the COVID crisis of 2020. They're going to do the exact same thing that they did then. They're going to slash interest rates and print a bunch of money. But given where we are right now, I don't believe we're going to get high like we did before. I think we're going to OD.
Episode 939, Pat Kamusu.
There's a big trend. There's a few big trends right now. One of them is, you know, stablecoin adoption and companies like PayPal and Square and others adopting blockchain rails to enable people accepting stable coins and other cryptocurrencies for payment. Mm-hmm. When you start doing that, you know, you're going to have just the traditional tax considerations and accounting considerations that are going to get more complicated. But on top of that, you have sales tax and VAT tax considerations. And it's, you know, one of the most widely overlooked things industry-wide. I'm one of really the only people discussing this topic of on-chain sales taxes. It's something that, you know, is going to become a bigger issue in years to come. But obviously, you know, the focus right now is on the federal level. But I actually wrote a book on this topic related to on-chain sales taxes and NFT sales taxes, because I think it's going to be a huge issue.
Episode 940, Andrew Wilkinson.
The real hole in anyone's education is options, I think. As I said earlier, people used to come to Interactive Brokers realizing that commissions were lower and that they were doing something more actively and in terms of trading stocks. Once they understand the stock market, how prices move, not just up, but also down, they start to learn about volatility. And when they learn about volatility, they realize that there's something very, very clinical that can be used to lever positions and to take advantage of market movements and to also hedge and speculate. And that is the world of options. And options are not easy unless you're actually trading them day in, day out to try and understand what will the price of an option be in the event that this stock price goes where I believe it's going to go.
Episode 941, Barry Eichengreen.
It makes sense to source dual-use technologies and products, things you need for your national security, mainly from your friends. And we used to call it near-shoring. In COVID days, it makes sense to ship stuff to economic partners nearby, given the disruptions that can occur from globalized long-distance shipping. But, you know, those rational motives for favoring some partners over others have spilled over into kind of an unrestrained nationalism, isolationism, what have you. Decoupling, complete and total decoupling between the United States and China is unlikely. We simply depend on one another.
Episode 942, Tom Nelson.
So you're diversified across equities and fixed income. On a global portfolio, it's different regions and countries and sectors and styles. And ultimately, that diversification across the asset classes and sub-asset classes and geographies is, while there's no free lunch, it's kind of as close as you can get by smoothing return streams, investing in different asset classes that aren't perfectly correlated, i.e. they don't go up and down at the same time and to the same level without really sacrificing expected returns. And so you can lower risk with without sacrificing returns.
Episode 943, Howard Linton.
I think the greatest thing to come along in since Robinhood is prediction markets. And I wish I could tell you I was early into that thing, but I wasn't. I'm an investor, a small amount personally in poly markets, so I'm talking my book. But in a prediction market, I can bet on Tesla beating earnings. The hardest part about saying a stock's going to beat earnings is predicting the direction of the stock. So you have to get two things right.
Right.
In your prediction. The idea that I could unbundle that and let people learn that, you know, I love Tesla. I think they're going to ship a lot of fucking cars this quarter. And, you know, and Elon sandbagging in. The fact that he can handicap it that way and just make a bet on Tesla beating is pretty cool.
Episode 944, Danielle DiMartino Booth.
There are 10 banks, 10, count them on two hands, 10 banks that have been brought into this First Brands or Tricolor mess where they've had major levels of charge-offs. So if nothing else, we can't, and we just had another subprime lender go belly up, by the way, called PrimaLend. We can certainly say that at least the practice among lenders was more widespread and more problematic than what we had thought it was. And, you know, look, this is part of life. If you want to find out where there is smoke, there's fire, so to speak, you find out where things have begun and the epicenter of them, and then you just fan it on out. And that's exactly what happened with off-balance sheet financing and Enron and WorldCom. We've seen these movies before, and we know how they end.
Episode 945, Vitaly Katsenilson.
I kind of draw a parallel between AI and the internet. But there is nuances. This is like, these parallels are never perfect, but there are certain things that are kind of similar. The internet was supposed to change the world, and it has. It has had, right? It has mm-hmm. incredible impact on us. In the short term, I would argue the impact was less than expected. And in the long term, impact was much greater than we expected. So it just takes time for those things to play out. Another thing is that the inflection point of this internet came in 2007-08. Mobile phones have changed the trajectory, kind of the slope of internet adoption and its pervasiveness.
Episode 946, Manuel Blay.
So this is why I also measure the trend of margin debt, but not based on moving averages because they don't work. I measure the trend based on Dow 30 patterns, which is different. Mm-hmm. In other words, now we can say that margin debt is very high. True. It's not at its highest if you divide per market cap. But who knows whether it's going to continue going higher? I have no idea. So we write trends. So it would be very tricky to call a top in the stock market because margin debt looks expensive. Furthermore, there is another study I performed that says that normally margin debt peaks some 5-6 months in advance of the stock market.
Episode 947, Ross Gerber.
Well, if you want to talk about bubbles, the private market is where it's at.
Yeah.
You're
talking about credit or equity or both?
Both. Yeah. Like the way my business is so freaking weird sometimes. Like the whole purpose of private investments was that it wasn't for the public. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And now they're trying to sell private investments to the public, but they're not liquid. And then what happens is you don't have a market. So they'll say, oh, we're raising at this valuation. We're raising at this valuation. But it doesn't mean those companies are worth that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, I understand. I get
it. So people are like, I want to get in on Anduril. And they're like, all right, well, we're raising money in Series F at, you can buy 5% of the company for, $75 billion, So is OpenAI worth $500 billion? Mm-hmm. Like, no way.
Right.
No way.
Right. Right.
But it doesn't matter.
Episode 948, Tim Knight.
There's this sort of miasma of risk on, risk off behavior. And, the fact that Bitcoin has just absolutely crumbled, I felt that had to have some negative influence in terms of people's just sheer confidence and cockiness. And so, yeah, we got up to around 127,000, I think early in October, I want to say. And I we were like at 85 today. The whole frothy optimism that we saw earlier this year was a combination of crypto doing well, Washington, D.C., a.k.a. Trump, supporting crypto every which way he could, stocks going higher and higher, the AI mania, all the rest of it.
Episode 949, Howard Silverblatt.
There are indices out there, S&P, other companies, private companies, public companies that you can go that invest differently and cap. So they'll go in that no issue could be more than so much percent, or most sector could be more than so much. You'll see that a lot in the dividends, so you don't end up with all utilities and financials. So those alternative types of investments have been around for decades. Again, up and down the low. The big cap ones, like the S&P 500, their methodology is not to cap those. Okay, and theoretically, yes, company can go all the way up. And the top of the Mag 7, which are 35%, are historically high levels. S&P in this index did not set that 35% for the top 10, okay? The market did by bidding them up.
Episode 950, Andrew Wilkinson.
The whole point of what we're doing here in the prediction markets is to try and help investors understand better what's actually happening in the real economy as pertains to what the central bank's doing, what economic data is doing, and how that can help an investor understand whether their portfolio is are they likely to do well with their portfolio, because some of these contracts, will retail sales be above a certain level at a certain point of the year? If you're long of retail stocks, you could take the opposing view if you felt that retail sales was about to decline. So again, it's all about calculating the odds, which is done for you, and expressing that view. So your 90 cents can become a dollar, your 10 cents could become a dollar if you get that right.
And that's gonna do it for 2025, my friends. Hope you enjoyed yourself throughout the year with what we put on as maybe sometimes entertaining, but more so educational on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you again for joining me. Thank you for telling your friends. Thank you for coming aboard and making this as rewarding for me as hopefully it is for you. I'll see you again next week with a great guest coming up. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the post or